Hello and welcome to Lost in Science. This is half an hour or thereabouts on your radio or podcasting device where we are talking about science. Who are we? Well, I am Stu, and with me this week I have Chris. How are you, Chris?
I am very good, thank you, Stu. Very excited to be here.
You sound so excited.
What
science is getting you excited this week, Chris?
Well, I have various kinds of stories I do. This one falls into the genre of Chris was wondering something and then decided to look up if there's any research on the topic.
I mean, that's always a good basis for a story is if you don't know about it, you go and find out more information.
That's right. And I found out a bunch of stuff. I didn't really entirely answer my question. But I end up with something that I guess, you know, could ended up being a Lost in Science Fiction Halloween story, but we'll live with that, the fact that it's the wrong time of year. But no, my question that I was wondering was essentially on the lines of how big could a lizard get?
Oh, okay. So, I mean, that's an interesting question, but I mean, obviously we think of dinosaurs as lizards, yeah, but they're not actually very closely related to lizards. That is a good question.
Yeah. I will explain, you know, in the story why I'm wondering this particular question. There is a reason for it. But, we have to take a quick detour via things like, you know, giant spiders and the Dimetrodon, which I'm not sure whether you're familiar with the Dimetrodon, but we will get into that. We'll, you know, sail right on past that one.
It sounds like you're in deep Ray Harryhausen's 50s sci-fi territory.
It does a little bit, doesn't it?
That's great. I'm talking about this week something which is probably on a lot of people's minds at the moment. Talking about oil, and a little bit about oil in Australia and. Why aren't we self-sufficient in oil, for one thing? Because I've heard a lot of people say, why aren't we? Why do we export oil? There's reasons for it, but I'm going to look at, you know, a bit of the science behind where do we get our oil, what oil do we have here in Australia, and you know, kind of why we're in the position we're in because of international affairs which are getting in the way of our oil supply. But also that's not the only reason prices have gone up, but it's a contributing factor. But anyway, I drilled down into it.
From fossils to fossil fuels, is that what you're doing here?
Hey, that's a very good segue, Chris. So stay tuned. We'll be back with that later in the show.
Okay, yes, you are listening to Lost in Science. Stu, my first question is for you. Do you know what a Dimetrodon is?
It's some kind of reptilian creature. I'm not sure I could pick it out of a lineup, but I'm pretty sure I have seen one at some point in a museum or in a picture book or something.
Yeah, you would have seen them in a lot of like dinosaur type stories. They're the ones with the big sail on the back.
Ah, yes. Generally, yeah. Yes, of course. Yes. I didn't know what that one was called when I was a kid, but I did have many plastic toys made out of fossil fuels of that dinosaur.
Yes, yeah, I'm sure you did. Not a dinosaur, though.
Dun, dun, dun. You mean the made in China toys were misleading me?
This is one of my gripes. Yeah, it is there as one of the most well-known characters in dinosaur stories, but not actually a dinosaur for various reasons. Not the least of which being that it lived in the Permian period and died out about 40 million years before dinosaurs came around. It's a long way away from any dinosaur times, really.
Is it a dinosaur ancestor? Is it in any way related, or is it just something that kind of looks a bit like dinosaur-y and...
Not actually a dinosaur ancestor. It is more related to... it's a synapsid, is what they call it. They're more related to mammals than to dinosaurs and other reptiles. So it was kind of reptilian, but its lineage basically led to mammals, whereas modern reptiles and dinosaurs split off long before that.
It has a common ancestor with dinosaurs, but it was way before Dimetrodon was around.
Exactly, exactly, exactly. So, much more, more ancestor mammals than of dinosaurs. But there are other ways that you can tell that it is not a dinosaur, apart from 40 million years, which is actually, I guess a fairly significant factor. And one of those is looking at the legs. It has very different legs to dinosaurs. The Dimetrodon, there could be in a bit of configuration, but generally quite splayed, kind of out to the side, whereas dinosaurs are more upright. And mammals, of course, as well. Dinosaurs and birds are kind of, I guess, more famous for being more upright in stance. This is something that I think when you particularly look at the dinosaur case, when you look at mammals, it can benefit us as bipeds. We can, run fast and this sort of thing. We can get around easily. Dinosaurs presumably benefited the same way, but also it would have allowed them to grow as large as they did. It would have been a contributing factor to that, because having your legs sticking out to the side, it's a lot harder to support a big weight. Whereas you've got, legs straight underneath you, you can hold up a longer weight, you can get stronger, thicker legs. Same as this is one of the factors that I think prevents us from having giant spiders, which are also, spiders also very famous for having legs, sticking out a long way. It's hard to know how big a spider could theoretically get, because there's a lot of other factors as well. And yeah, it is hard to figure it out. You can look at evolution for a guide. The largest spider in the world is the Goliath bird eater, Theraphosa blondii, with the legs being up to 28 centimeters and a weight of 170 grams. So kind of nearly a foot in span. The actual largest leg span is the giant huntsman from Laos, has about 30 centimeters. But, that's what evolution has achieved. So you can imagine that's kind of pushing the maximum of what a spider could actually do without collapsing under its own weight or not being able to breathe and that sort of thing.
Yeah, I think the other one that I've heard is with arthropods is their breathing so different. Yeah. It's very hard to diffuse the oxygen into the body beyond a certain size, which is one of the other limits they have.
Yeah, and look, there are theories that if spiders were to try and evolve, if such a thing is possible, like trying to do something, then they would need to evolve, lungs. Maybe an internal skeleton to support them. But even then, it's not clear how big the skeleton would allow them to get without completely changing, their leg structure. This is my quick digression to science fiction, because this sort of configuration is very, popular as for monsters in science fiction. You think of, the Mind Flayer in Stranger Things, which is kind of a big spidery arthropod-looking creature. The monster in Cloverfield has kind of really big splayed limbs. This sort of thing, I think, looks creepy in fiction, but maybe is not really practical for giant monsters.
Yeah, probably the reason that they make giant monsters look like things that creep people out is because they're in horror movies and they creep people out.
Exactly, exactly. So this is what got me, along with the Dimetrodon, thinking about, what are the limits? Like, how big could you get with legs like that?
Mm.
And it's instructive then to look at actual animals that do have a big size variation, but with this configuration. And I'm thinking in particular of lizards.
Mm.
And I did manage to find a paper that kind of looked at this question. It was from 2016. It was in the journal Frontiers in Zoology, and it was by Taylor Dick and Christopher Clement. And it was called How to Build Your Dragon, Scaling of Muscle Architecture from the World's Smallest to the World's Largest Monitor Lizard. So what they did is they looked at a particular genus of lizards, the monitor lizards, which is Varanus, and they looked at how basically muscles compared across the big size range. So the smallest monitor lizard is the short-tailed pygmy monitor, Varanus brevicata, which I think the maximum size you get to is about 25 centimeters mm-hmm. in length. So slightly smaller than your giant spider, I guess, that we were talking about earlier. The largest is, of course, the Komodo dragon, Varanus komodoensis, which It's only about 10 times the size, but that's like, you know, 2.5 meters or maybe even up to 3 meters. So that's a pretty big lizard when you think about it. So that's quite a big size variation. But all these lizards, they do look fairly similar. The fact they're in one genus, as you can probably imagine, you know, suggests that they're quite closely related. And they have a similar kind of leg configuration, I suppose, leg stance. The ones that climb trees generally do have more splayed legs because when you're climbing, you know, vertically, you want to keep fairly flat to what you're climbing on for stability purposes. But even the ones that run around on the ground still have, you know, legs out to the side and that sort of thing. So yeah, they compared the muscles and they found that yes, as they got larger, the muscles got bigger, as you can imagine. But they also got more specialized and dedicated to supporting the weight. So they're very kind of strong, sturdy muscles that were essentially holding up the weight of the creature. Instead of relying on, you know, like with the dinosaurs or with us, you know, the skeleton to be in a certain configuration that is a lot more stable, they rely on their muscles to hold them up, which clearly is working for them. I mean, the Komodo dragon is quite large, but it comes at the cost of things like agility, as you can imagine. They can't run very fast. And this has been noticed before that the larger monitor lizards are a lot slower than you would expect them to be if you just kind of scaled them up. And it's because the muscles are different. The muscles are not there for like short running, like sprinting essentially, for fast movement. They're there for strength and holding up this large creature.
Yeah, I was thinking that because I've seen goannas run quite fast, scarily fast if they're running towards you. Yeah. But yeah, you see Komodo dragon, or the footage I've seen of Komodo dragons, they're very kind of lumbering animals. They're slow moving by comparison.
Yeah, and this is this then kind of gives some clues about, say, the largest ever of these lizards, which was the extinct Megalania, the giant, you know, flesh-eating goanna from prehistoric Australia, Varanus priscus, which they believe might have grown up to 7 meters in length, so much, much bigger than your Komodo dragon. And as you can imagine, that would mean it would be much, much slower than even a Komodo dragon. So it would probably have been unable to chase down prey like humans or other animals.
So possibly
humans did believe to cross over with it. Yeah.
Possibly a carrion eater and sort of picking up what was left over after something else had done the capturing.
Yeah. So I guess that kind of like, it doesn't really answer that question. How large could they possibly be? Basically they've gotten as large as they could and it is at a big cost to their, I guess, you know, their movement. You know, if they wanted to get bigger, they would have to try and evolve like those hypothetical giant spiders and evolve a different leg configuration, which, again, that's what evolution does. The Dimetrodon, as I said, is an ancestor of, well, comes from a line that was an ancestor of mammals, and mammals evolved upright limbs. So, you know, over millions of years, it can happen. I should also point out it can go the other way as well. Crocodiles also have that splayed leg thing, but their ancestor was actually kind of had long skinny legs and ran around with kind of upright legs.
Well, that's a terrifying thought.
Years ago. it is a bit. So it's even believed that some crocodilomorphs, I think they call them, some of them actually ran on two legs, which is another
horrifying,
scary thought for you. But, you know, and there have been, I think even in prehistoric, more, you know, more recent prehistory in Australia, there were terrestrial crocodiles that were mostly out of the water. But yeah, most crocodiles now are more aquatic and I guess, yeah, use the water to support their weight. So on land, they don't need that efficient running. But their ancestors might have did it. So there you go. The conclusion is splayed legs, not great for growing really big. You can make it work, but at a push. And if you want to grow huge like dinosaurs or mammals like elephants, then best to go with the upright legs. That's our evolutionary tip for anyone out there who's listening and contemplating the next stage of development, I guess.
I have an unorthodox solution, a fantastic voyage, if you will. Hey! Three scientists will be shrunk to microscopic size. Well, we have had a little trouble finding volunteers.
Lost in science. I think we're lost.
We're not lost.
Not even any short-range radio signals yet?
Except for a single, very powerful radio emission.
Of course, a transmitter of that sort isn't exactly standard equipment.
The science and technology must be absolutely mind-boggling.
Of course, that's mostly on the theoretical side.
What so far?
Across Australia on the Community Radio Network, you're listening to Lost in Science.
How about that price of petrol, huh?
Oh, look, you know, we shouldn't be using it anyway, Stu. I think that's the message there that I'm getting out of it.
Luckily, in Victoria, they've made public transport free for a month, which is a good way to help people not rely on their cars so much, but that's reliant on you living in the city, I suppose, as well, where there's public transport to use. But I've noticed there's a lot of opinions flying around about petrol prices and what Australia should do and shouldn't do about it right now and what we should do in the future. This is the bread and butter of social media, is people arguing about what they reckon. But I was told when I was quite young by someone very qualified that an opinion is worth exactly what you pay for it. Bearing that in mind, I'm going to give some opinions based on realities about the truth of Australia's oil production and what it actually means and what Australia can actually do about something that is kind of beyond our control in some ways.
Because this is clearly not the first time that we've had an issue with oil supplies. I mean, the 1970s.
Yeah, several times in my life there have been global events that affected people's ability to purchase petrol. I did have a look for the science of where we get our oil and what sort of oil do we have in Australia. This is all from Geoscience Australia. If you want to look it up, it's all on the internet if you really want to dig even deeper. I did it. First of all, incidentally, and I have said this before, oil and coal are called fossil fuels not because they are made of fossils. They are made of fossils, but that's not why they're called fossil fuels.
Okay, so why are they called fossil fuels?
They are called fossil fuels because they are removed from the ground. That's what fossil means. So fossil artifacts of plants and animals got the same name because they were dug up. Or fossicked is another word that we use with the same root. Oh. So the fossil fuels were called fossil fuels long before anyone really had any understanding of fossils. They've been called fossils since the late 17th century, and no one really was talking about fossils as if they were really old. They just knew that they dug them out of the ground, and that's why they're called that. But anyway, they are made of fossils, it turns out, but the word fossil has changed its meaning to mean really old, which is interesting, I think. In Australia, we have a few different types of fossil fuels that have been identified in different places. We've got a huge country. There's going to be all sorts of geological formations, which is why we can find different things in different places. We have natural gas deposits, we have crude oil deposits, we have LPG we can extract, we have other fuels like coal of varying degrees of quality depending where they're dug up. But basically, let's focus on the liquids because they're the ones that are under threat at the moment and is attracting people's attention. So the big one currently making the news right now is crude oil. And the crude oil is the basis for a number of refined products, including petroleum, which is what most people put in their car. Many motor vehicles rely on petroleum, and distillate, which is the basis of diesel fuel, which is used in trucks and heavy machinery. So industrial vehicles use diesel for the most part. Non-electric vehicles that are in domestic use generally use petrol. But if we look at the consumption of crude oil in Australia, the figure comes out at just over 1 million barrels per day. So we use about 1.15 million barrels of crude oil a day. But we don't put, that's not what you're buying at the Bowser. You're buying a product that's made of crude oil for whatever application it is. And there's a number of other products that are made out of crude oil as well. So if we look at that as a million barrels a day, it's not really giving us an accurate figure of what we're actually using in applications that we use it for. So if you want to look this up, the way oil as a resource is measured commonly is either as a measure of energy contained in the oil, which they measure in petajoules, so like megajoules and...
How much is a peta?
A lot.
10 to the 15th or something like that.
Yeah, it's a lot of zeros. But so you can convert petajoules into barrels or millions of barrels, which they do refer to millions of barrels, which is just what it sounds like. You're talking about barrels, actual barrels of oil or you know, equivalent volume of a barrel. But the conversion rate between petajoules and barrels of oil is about 1 million barrels of oil per 5.7 petajoules. But that's an average because the potential energy varies according to the actual quality of the oil that's contained. So there's different grades of oil. There's different geological features that contribute to the type of oil you can extract and all these things. But it's around about 1 million barrels per 5.7 petajoules. And thinking about it in terms of energy is probably the one way of doing it if you're looking at it scientifically. But if you're talking about quantities, then the million barrels is probably the way to think of it. So Australia produces around 127 million barrels of crude oil per year from our known sources of crude oil, which we are extracting. But we export about 109 million barrels of crude oil per year for various reasons. And then we also import about 68 million barrels of crude oil per year. So that the amount we extract of crude oil, we sell quite a lot of it. We buy in other crude oil from other sources. And we refine some of that ourselves, but we also buy in refined product well. So it's not as simple, we have this much crude oil, we turn it to petrol. So the reason we sell and buy and there's a big trade in crude oil is because the products we actually use require the oil that we can extract in Australia is a relatively, they call it a light oil. It's not
like olive oil.
It's not quite extra virgin olive oil, but it's not an appropriate substrate to make petrol on its own. So we need to get other oils from other locations to mix with it to even refine it into petrol and distillate. Although, you know, the diesel engine was invented to basically burn anything vaguely flammable that you threw at it. They're not designed that way anymore, but that was the original basis of the design of the engine. But so we dump all that. Well, we extract all that oil. Some of it we sell, some of it we refine on shore. We buy in oil that we also refine on shore, but we also buy in a whole lot of refined product and use that directly. So it's a very complicated trade. The thing is, with the oil we have, it can be cheaper to ship our oil overseas, let someone else refine it in a really big factory, and then it's cheaper to buy back the refined product than ship the other ingredients here and refine it ourselves. So there's reasons to do that. We kind of lack the industrial capacity for some of that refining processes that we would need to do, partly because a lot of the refineries have been shut down in the last 30 years, but we don't really have the economies of scale in Australia to justify building the kind of plants that you need to do the refining to produce the products that we want. It's Australia's not a big enough market to justify the cost of those kind of refineries. Even if we did build them, you wouldn't make enough money out of it selling the product here. So you'd still be exporting it in the end. You'd just be importing a lot of stuff to then export it again, which is kind of not great economics. So there's a variety of different actual products that result from the refining and result from all this trade. We do extract some oil here. We refine some of it here. We buy back other oil products to use here, and it's all a tangled economic web as far as how we actually access our fuel supplies. But you'll hear people talking about resources we have that we're not using. And these are what are known in geoscience terms as unconventional resources. And some people seem to think they would solve our problems if we didn't export oil and we used all the unconventional sources, we could be somehow self-sufficient in our fuel supplies. But you're talking about, when you're talking about unconventional sources, you're talking about things like shale oil. And there's no commercial shale oil production in Australia at all. Nobody's pulling it out of the ground. It's really expensive to set up. It's really expensive to extract. The quality is not great. And nobody's seriously attempted to do it in Australia because of there's so many difficulties. It has been done in other parts of the world. And again, the economies of scale may not be there to even warrant the effort. There's some potential in unconventional resources. They require a lot of investment to bring them into production and years of development to bring them to market. It's worth noting, if conventional oil reserves continue to be extracted at currents and lacking any new discoveries, Australia's crude oil production will last about 6 years. Not to suggest there won't be any new discoveries, but it's possible that rather than looking to increase domestic production of oil, we should perhaps be looking for alternative energy sources that are not so influenced by external activities. You know, if only there was some free source of energy that we could tap into that was shining all over the country all the time, that might be a useful alternative. And that is all we have time for this week on Lost in Science. Thank you for joining us in Getting Lost. If you have any questions or suggestions for the team, get in touch with us by email. We are lostinsci@gmail.com. You can send cheap tweets to us at lostinscience1 on Twitter, or you can find us on the ubiquitous Facebook. Lost in Science is recorded at the studios of 3CR in Melbourne on the land of the Kulin Nation and is broadcast across Australia on the Community Radio Network with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can find a podcast version of the show on 3cr.org.au, or you can tune in the way you did this week when we return in our usual time slot to get
Lost in Science!
Thanks for listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online.